We're happy to welcome in our friend David Roth from Defector and the co-host of the Distraction Podcast. Greetings, Mr. Roth.
Hey, man. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks. How's your Monday?
You know, it's Monday. It's like, could be better, could be worse. I'd move it later in the week if I could. I'd bump it ahead like 3-4 days. But that's not, I don't really have the option of doing that. So I'm just dealing with it. I wrote about the Cincinnati Reds. I'm editing a story about Craig Finn of the Hold Steady. It's a pretty solid Defector day so far.
Nice. Well, but you must be reading my mind, because I had a top of my list of things to ask you about was the Cincinnati Reds, apparently inspired by your piece recently on janky no-hitters.
Yeah, that's what I was writing about. On Sunday, their young ace, former number two pick in the Major League Baseball June draft, a guy named Hunter Green, threw a 7 1/3 inning, 5-walk no-hitter that the team lost. That's not something that happens very often, and yet, as I wrote in the blog, I kind of feel like it could happen to the Reds like 4 or 5 more times this year. They're just absolutely in the forbidden zone, and there's nothing that I would rule out happening to them, like up to and including like some sort of minor like an infestation of some kind in their clubhouse. Like maybe there are wolves in there for a month this year. You can't say it's not going to happen.
Yeah, when you start the season 3-22, you should expect the unexpected.
Yeah. I mean, they have a 1-20 stretch on their docket. Like, just think about what that means, you know? Like, it means it's not going to happen twice, but they're bad enough that it could happen once, which means, you know, any sort of other option is there. The thing that's been really weird with that to me is I always thought of them as being a team that had really devoted, like, sort of loyal fans, and they do. I mean, I have been writing about them kind of a lot this year. Their opening day is, like, literally they have a parade, the kids get off from school. It's a big deal. And it was on the day of their home opener that the son of the owner went on the team's flagship radio station to basically taunt the team's fans. Like, there are some impossibly bad vibes around that team this year. I wish them best, you know, like in the same way that it's like the one year the Mets are good, but I have to like find some other bad team to be obsessed with. But I'm very fixated on the Reds right now.
The Mets aren't just good, but they seem to be fairly well functioning right now. How much of this is a product of new ownership, and how much credit does Buck Showalter get?
I think that it's a combination of the two. Like, I think that it's hard to tell, you know, like what Buck is doing right or wrong during the games. I guess he hasn't been as bad at managing the bullpen as I'd feared. You know, when your last act as a manager going into this is losing a playoff game without even getting your closer up, like that's, I came in nervous about that, you know, and I think generally the vibe on the team has been pretty good. It's hard to say that much of that is, you know, on him, although, you know, this is mostly just because I don't know what managers do, you know, like it's sort of hard to tell. Like, they look great when things are going well. And then, you know, with the exception of like guys like Bobby Valentine or whatever, where you can't not notice what they're doing, like this is very different. But I think there's something about the players that they brought in. And then there's just this natural kind of irritant that happens in New York. The tabloids love to goof on the Mets. They complain about the Yankees. They, you know, gnash their teeth if the team ever loses. But the Mets, they kind of cover the way that they used to cover, like, Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton in, like, 2005. That they're more just a team that keeps providing, you know, upskirt photos and embarrassing feuds in public. And so when they're actually playing like a normal baseball team, that is just not in the equation. There's no one trying to stir stuff up.
We're talking with David Roth here on Downtown. We're all abuzz here in New England with the Boston Celtics, dispatching with Giannis and those Milwaukee Bucks, and are now one of the final four in the NBA. There will be a new champion this year. Who do you like?
I mean, I'm not just saying this to pander to your listeners, although I hope by now it's not clear. It's perfectly clear that I'm not above that in any way.
No, of course not.
But the Celtics look incredibly good to me. And that was without Robert Williams, who's one of my favorite sort of supporting players to watch. I mean, they won that series basically without him. And to get past, I mean, the thing with beating a team with Giannis on it is that you can do like everything right. I mean, Grant Williams had an amazing series defending him, like such a good series defending him that I feel like he could defend anybody. And Giannis still had 40 points every night. It's just, that's what he is at this point. He's got that like sort of young Shaq type of effect on games. But man, they really just, to watch the Celtics play, the way the ball moves, the way that everybody sort of seems to know their role and embrace it, it's, a friend of mine, a coworker at Defector, said that it was like the whole team just decided to become Marcus Smart, and there's like a selflessness and an effort there that I think, I mean, I think they would be a fun champion. I think the Warriors would be fun champions too. I don't really like the Heat. I don't really like the Mavs, but I do think that at the very least, like, just knowing that both of last year's finalists are out is kind of a relief. As like, you know, it's not like everybody's sick of the Bucks and the Suns being in the finals every year. Like, I got all the way through my life without either of those teams getting there until last year. But the at this point, I think it's going to be fun to see a little bit of like some legacy teams, and then also, you know, I think the Celtics are going to impress national audiences. People are just going to have to forget that they're the Celtics. They're going to fully enjoy the experience.
And I love the fact that they got to a game seven, and apparently Ime Udoka, but also everybody in the team, said to Grant Williams, hey, if they're not going to play any defense on you, you shoot those threes all night long. And he's like, okay, I'll take 18 of them then, and I'll score 27 points.
It does have that kind of, you know, circa now 2022 NBA thing where it just kind of feels like you're playing like a video game against somebody who's just mashing the B button over and over again. You know, like it doesn't feel scientific. And yet, like, it definitely worked. I mean, just look at that game yesterday and just see that both the Grant Williams game and the Peyton Pritchard game, both of which are things that I would not have imagined were even on the menu of possibilities. They both happened at the same time in a game seven against the defending champions, and it worked. So, like, that's the kind of weirdness that makes you think that there's maybe something percolating there. Mm. Kind of the opposite of whatever the Suns were about. I mean, I've never seen a team fall apart like that in a game seven. I don't think ever.
What are you writing about Craig Finn? I like Craig Finn a lot.
Oh, I'm reading about him.
Oh, you're reading? Okay.
The writer Robert O'Connell has interviewed him and wrote a terrific piece about him. It's one of those sort of things that, you know, it was fun to assign, but as an editor, I had to try to act like I didn't really want to, you know, like I was just sort of, you know, disinterestedly assigning it. This is one of my favorite writers on a guy that I think is a fantastic subject. And I had to kind of like try to keep the poker face and be like, yeah, maybe our readers would like this story. I don't know. Maybe I could edit it. I guess maybe I could edit it. If you want me to edit it, I could do it.
So that's your management style, huh?
Yeah. Very, it's the art of war. So you can see that I was doing some Sun Tzu on my coworkers there. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing from one moment to the next, Rich. We both know this. It's part of the thrill of being me. But it's a fun story, and he comes across as a very interesting man. I mean, it's kind of just a question of, like, you know, the interesting idea of the story is, like, sort of what is a band like The Hold Steady, where it's all about, you know, being surrounded by other sweaty people yelling in a bar or a club. Like, you know, what is that after the last 2 years of avoiding everyone physically, you know? And he had some interesting thoughts on it.
What's the COVID situation in New York? Have people decided it's completely over?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, it's like the actual answer to what the situation is poor. The cases are up. Hospitalizations are not up. Deaths are thankfully not up. But it is, you know, there's a lot of virus out there. I have friends who've been testing positive. And, you know, it's tough. Like, you still see, I think, in situations where people obviously wore masks in the past, you know, that like in a supermarket or on the subway, I think you're still seeing pretty good adherence to it. The real difference has just been that all of the other stuff, you know, some of it kind of TSA style security theater, and some of it I think actually meaningful. So they're not checking, you know, vaccination cards or anything like that at restaurants or anywhere else. But mostly, you know, every customer service experience at this point is almost all of them are maskless, which is strange because I think that was one of those things that I sort of assumed would go on for a long time, but I guess you can't underestimate what 2 years of having to bust tables with a mask on does to a person.
How are your crypto investments working out?
Terrific. I went to the moon. So I've been kind of fascinated by it. I've been trying to figure out how I feel about all of it. Because the schadenfreude of seeing the most annoying people on Twitter, and like just to pause for a moment, think about what that means. Like,
right.
If you spend any time on Twitter, like, this is like,
so not just normal real world annoying, but Twitter annoying.
Twitter, yes. I mean, like, I don't know what it would be like to be around a Bitcoin maximalist in real life. I'm assuming that it would be, you know, in terms of the tone and the beats of it, that it would be exactly the same as being attacked by, like, a puma or a jaguar or something. But in terms of, like, what the experience of it online, it went instantly from all of these people with laser eye emojis or laser eye, you know, avatars on their Twitter feeds, constantly haranguing anybody that doubted Bitcoin to, like, you know, enjoy being poor, like, you can catch me on my compound, to as soon as that stuff crashed, all of them being like, you have no idea how bad it looks for you to be laughing at this. Think about El Salvador. And the fact of the matter is, it's not wrong. El Salvador's economy is leveraged in large part on Bitcoin because of their kooky president, and that really is bad for them, and it's not like they needed more bad news. But at the same time, if I can't laugh at someone who is telling me 24 hours earlier to enjoy being poor for the rest of my life, then what rights do I even have as an American?
Right.
If I can't do that.
See, I'm so torn because I would watch the Twitter gurus and think maybe I should get into Bitcoin, but then I would turn on Fox News and think that I need to put everything into gold and survival gear.
Yeah, this is one way or another. The one thing that everybody agrees is that actual money is out. It's got to be either something that somebody made up, or like a drawing of a cartoon ape that's got like a blunt in its mouth and an apey hat on. Either that's the future of money, or we're all going to be eating out of weird, like, sort of the same size as a drywall pail, but it's full of stew, and you buy it from, like, an evangelist on Fox. One way or another, that's the future. I don't really love it, personally. Like, I'd like to just keep on, you know, getting stuff from the store and making it for dinner at dinner time, but whatever. We'll see how it plays out.
All right, now, we have a theory around here that we've floated for the last several weeks, that we believe the whole Elon Musk buying Twitter thing was never going to happen, and that Twitter simply called his bluff and now he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that not knowing what to do is, like, if anything, kind of generous. I feel like he sort of, I mean, again, this is one of those things where, I don't know if this is counts as laughing at a Bitcoin maximalist. I don't think he's got very many people in his life that, not just who are going to tell him no, but who might be like, with respect, sir, calm down. He just kind of can't do it. And so at this point, once he, you know, it's a case of kind of like being epic gone wrong. Like, he just kind of couldn't back out of what was obviously, I think at the time, a bad deal. It seems like it's, I mean, the Tesla's stock has lost like 25% of its value in the last week. Like, he's like, it really is coming a cropper for him as a result of this. And yet I don't think he's really, like, I don't think he considered the possibility that it could have repercussions, because nothing he's done has had repercussions for him at all. And I think that, you know, it's going to be hard to see him sort of unwind it. It's strange, because I think that in a lot of ways, Twitter has been better in the last few years. Not just, you know, I think banning Trump helped the vibe. I mean, just that by subtraction thing, I think, really did make a difference in terms of the day-to-day experience of being on there. But lately, Elon has kind of taken on that role of, like, you know, just if there was like a clown that everyone had to spend 3 hours a day looking at while it just, like, honked a horn right in your face, you know, like, it kind of doesn't matter how that clown is made up. One way or another, you're going to be like, I don't like this clown. Like, and I don't like his opinions, but also, like, I just don't care for the horn honking all the time. And so if Elon wanted to make himself that figure, like, I guess you'd say it's a success, but yeah, I don't think I don't think he's in a position to buy it.
No, to me, he seems like that kid that goes, I'm going to hold my breath till I turn blue. If you don't let me, well, go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Then Twitter, you know, and then he's got nothing, and he is lashing out and trying to, you know, so it's just going to end with him paying Twitter $1 billion for nothing.
Yep.
To get out of the deal.
When you have that many billions of dollars, you can sort of afford it. I just think there has to be a better way to spend $1 billion than, like, trying to get more Twitter followers over the course of a few weeks. It's strange, too, because it's like the people that actually had money in Twitter, as with all of this stuff, you know, once you start dealing with things that are capitalized like that, you know, it's like you start seeing a lot of mentions of, like, the Saudi royal family. And I'm like, well, I don't like that either. You know, there's a lot of, like, who owns what. And then certainly in terms of there was stuff that was just coming out today in terms of the people that were backing Musk's investment in Twitter and the people that have some interest in erasing what they perceive to be anti-conservative bias on it. And so it's all the same Trump guys that you, well, I mean, not necessarily Trump guys, but like Larry Ellison and Peter Thiel, like just basically our richest reactionaries who have that kind of extra money to kick to him and are like, yeah, it would be great if you did this and then, you know, made it illegal to say, you know, these five things that I don't like. And, you know, I can't feel bad for any of those guys. You know, like I can't feel good about the Saudi royal family continuing to have whatever it's 10% stake in Twitter. But yeah, at some point, like I would take the status quo over any future that was led by Elon.
Now, have you ever, under cover of your secret online identity, ever wandered over into the Truth Social neighborhood?
No, I should. I've heard really great things about the truths and the retruths. It seems like with all of those things, so this is kind of a sad story, but at the end of Trump's father's life, I remember reading about this, and it really stuck with me. His father had Alzheimer's and was, you know, a nasty man by all accounts. But he wouldn't stop going into the office, and it got to the point where he couldn't be involved in any of his enterprise's, you know, deals because he was very diminished. But they set him up, they left him in his office, they had a phone that only connected to his secretary. Periodically they would just bring in papers to sign with just nothing written on them. And that was how he spent the rest of his days. That was what he wanted to do. And I feel like Truth Social is basically that experience, but online for Trump. But the idea is more or less that they needed to, like, he's not going to get back on Twitter. He doesn't want to be on any of the other social media sites because they stink. Like, they're just full of fascists and typos. And while he has no, you know, interest in reading other people's posts, he doesn't want to be where the nerds are. He wants to be where everybody is and where they're paying attention. And so the idea of just creating, like, a little fake Twitter for him and being like, here you go, sir. Like, this is all yours. And everybody loves your posts. They're doing great. Like that could actually work on him, I feel like, but only because of his, you know, longstanding struggles with like object permanence.
As always, you have nailed it completely, Mr. Roth. Thank you again. David Roth, Defector, the Distraction Podcast. Always great to talk with you, my friend. When is that main trip coming up for you?
So we got two. I appreciate, first of all, thank you for asking. We're going to be up in June. We're actually flying in and out of Bangor that time around. So I was going to hit you up offline and see if there's any chance of an in real life downtown get together.
Oh my God, that would
like to see it.
That would be incredible. Absolutely.
Yeah,
yes.
And then we're doing a longer trip at the end of August into September. But yeah, we're looking forward to it. This first one is mostly just to move heavy things around my father-in-law's house. But we get to be in Maine while we do it. So that's not so bad.
All right. I generally don't do heavy lifting, but for you, I would drop that.
I wasn't trying to enlist your man with a van services, but if you're interested in helping us move some scrap metal for my father-in-law, I'll hit you up.
That's what I live for, David. We'll talk.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Thanks, David. David Roth with us here on Downtown.